Members, we're going to call the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. Members, we're going to start down the path of hearing bills for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Today is Thursday, for those of you that don't remember what day of the week we're on. And it'll be the first day, and then next week we'll continue along this way, and then maybe I'll give more information as staff tells me what's going on, and we'll lay out a roadmap for next week so that members of both sides of the aisle and the audience know what's going on as far as when we can anticipate our omnibus bill coming out and the discussion that we're going to take with that. Representative Shoemaker, thank you. Welcome here. Representative Anderson, do you want to move his bill for possible inclusion?
I will do that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson moves House File 185 for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Shoemaker. Begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 185 simply takes the fines that the PCA collects over their work and takes the funds and puts them into the general fund instead of going back into the environmental fund. And that's all it does.
All right. Well, thank you. Nice, simple bill. We like simple bills. Representative Wagenius.
Yeah, a couple of questions, Mr. Chair. Why?
Representative Shoemaker.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think that taking the onus off of the PCA when they're trying to do their job so it doesn't look like they're maybe having some ulterior motive for trying to collect fines or up their fines in order to line their own pocketbook is something we want to do. We want to make sure that the PCA is able to do their job without having any kind of question drawn upon them from the people that they are assessing fines to.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
A couple of follow-ups, Mr. Chair. What do you mean line your pocket? They don't get the money to take home.
Representative Shoemaker, you know what? Let's bring, is somebody here from the PCA that can tell us specifically what's the current, where does the money go? So the members that may not have been here before. Ms. Hallbeck, if you could come down and tell us currently where the money goes, to what fund and how it's accessed, and then potentially what would be different with Representative Shoemaker's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Myrna Hallbeck. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency in the Fiscal Division. And just a little history until the last biennium, we did a split. The penalties that we collect were split between the general fund and the environmental fund. It now moves to the environmental fund, but it does move at the fund level, not to the enforcement staff. So we have a disconnect by the penalties that they assign in how we allocate the money back out. So this is a small component. The staff have no ability to gain personally in the program or individually by any penalties they assess. And the process we really assess is comparing that to other like indications. So this is really about for us, if this entirely moves to the general fund, leaves a $1.5 million hole in the general or in the environmental fund that we'll somehow have to make up. Because this is done in isolation and not connected yet to the budget bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. I think you were still had more questions, Representative Wagenius, or?
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
I did. I was wondering about the way this is funded right now. It is with the majority of the money comes from the fees that we pay on our garbage. So if there's a hole in the fund, are you anticipating that there be an increase in the garbage fees to pay for this? And I would ask the representative.
Representative Shoemaker or Ms. Hallbeck.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm told that it's not only the salvage or the garbage that's being collected, but also the fees that go into paying for
this. Ms. Hallbeck, could you elaborate?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Wagenius is correct that the Environmental Fund is made up of a number of revenue sources, one of them which is the solid waste tax, and one of them is this penalty fees that go into the fund, as well as the permit activities to pay our regulatory program. And so it is a combination of all of those. So we will either be reducing our activities in the agency to make up for this reduction, or we will have to look at permit application fees or the annual fees to make up for this change.
Ms. Hallbeck, if I could ask, I remember one year, I think it was a couple years ago, as we were dealing with the challenges of the emerging ethanol business and the rising price of gasoline, there was cases where the ethanol businesses got some really huge fines for, if I remember right, overuse of water or overproduction beyond what their permits were. And there was significant fines for them not compiling or going along with what they were supposed to be doing. And at that time, did the money go to the general fund? It was in the millions, I remember then. Or did it go into the environmental fund? Where did that there was one spike, I think, for a year or two where there was some large fines.
Mr. Chair, as we started those enforcement activities, a portion of them started in the biennium where we were still splitting the penalties between the general fund and the environmental fund. And then, yes, there was a spike that started the very first year that all of the penalties went into the environmental fund. But remind us all that our process takes some time between understanding there's a violation, moving through that administrative, and when we collect the dollars.
Okay. And the environmental fund is a significant part of the MPCA's budget. So if money goes into the environmental fund, it gives more money to the MPCA's budget. Again, how big is the environmental fund as a part of the entire MPCA's budget?
Mr. Chair, members, the environmental fund is nearly three-quarters of our budget. We have the remediation fund, which is about 22%, the federal dollars, which are about 13%, the general fund, which right now is about 5%.
Okay.
My numbers are wrong, but...
So where the point that these people don't directly receive, and we certainly, I think most of us understand that, the environmental fund is an important fund for the operations of MPCA. And I think that's important for folks to know. That's not to mean that people are doing anything to line their own pockets per se, but the reality is that fund makes up the majority and a significant part of that budget. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we just should all remind ourselves that there are groups of permits that don't pay for their whole cost of permitting. And ethanol doesn't pay for its whole cost of permitting. Mining doesn't pay for its whole cost of permitting. And I can say that clearly, because it 4 years ago we gave the agency I think $2 million, but I may be wrong about that figure, but it had a million in it to subsidize and move those permits faster. Water does not pay for its own permits, so to the extent we take money out of the environment fund, the way that they will be funded is people will have to start paying their own fees. And I think we just have to understand that is the consequence.
Well, and I think Representative Wagenius, you raise a great point. From one side of looking at something, we say that a business or a person or an individual farmer that maybe has an irrigation permit isn't paying the cost of that permit. Well, if you're the farmer and you're paying hundreds or thousands of dollars for water permits, in your mind, you're wondering, what in the world? I've never seen anybody. I hope they're doing something with this money. What is this money that I send to the bureaucracy doing? And that's our job, to educate them that, yes, there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes. We've got monitoring wells, and we're evaluating the chemicals or whatever it is. But in a lot of their cases, they look and say, can't you deliver that service better to where it seems like I'm paying a lot for what I'm getting? And so that's a discussion we're going to have, and that's a hard discussion. Members, follow-up, Representative Lagina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if we saw some of the fees for permits for water, we would say that's not very much. So I think we just have to see the consequence of shifting and saying, okay, general fund, you get the money, and taking it out of this area, then requiring the consequence. Looking at the consequences of our actions. And I'm not sure it's a consequence we want, but if that is a consequence that we want, then we can do it. It's just understanding the consequences.
Thank you. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius, I do think that if we take care of the duplicative activities that this agency does that are already being, you know, part of DNR and other agencies, we can probably help them resolve a shortfall in that fund by getting rid of activities that aren't really to the core of their mission. And I think that's another way we can resolve it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question maybe for Mr. Reinholds or Ms. Hallback. I seem to remember when we were having the overviews that the environmental fund is going to go out of balance in the near future. What is that, and what and when is going to happen with the environmental fund without this bill?
Thank you. And Representative Shoemaker, you're here because your bill affects the environmental fund, so you get to be part of a bigger discussion. So I hope you don't have a place to be for a little while. Because it does affect your bill. Ms. Hallbeck, to Representative Hansen's question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, and I think Mr. Reinholz has the actual numbers, but we have out into the out years, we have balanced the budget and that assumes the $1.5 million being in the environmental fund. If it is not, we will, in order to balance the budget, need to reduce expenditures in that equal amount.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. Mr. Reinholz, anything to add? Mr. Reinholz.
Mr. Chairman, no, I have the actual number. It shows $1 million, just over $1 million balance in 14, so that would be definitely the approximately $4 million in deficit if we took away $1.5 million each year.
Thank you, Mr. Reinholz. Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shoemaker, did you know when you introduced the bill that would throw the environmental fund out of balance if it did pass?
Representative Shoemaker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I knew that there would be changes to the way that it would be funded.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
So changes, but didn't realize that it would put the environmental fund into the red.
Representative Shoemaker, I think Representative Hansen's asking you if you know that you're going to put more money into the general fund that could go to schools or textbooks or maybe back to the environment general fund for state parks, but you would take money away from the environmental fund.
Mr. Chair, if that's what's in the general fund, then that's what this money would be going to then.
Well, it's just some of the things the general fund's used for. Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, it could also be viewed as raiding the dedicated funds that people pay fees for to balance the general fund and to put money into that. So raiding the dedicated dollars that hardworking Minnesotans pay fees for to go for specific purposes instead of balancing the budget in other ways, actually doing what's been done before of raiding the dedicated dollars.
Representative Shoemaker, I've got a feeling that the people that live in your district didn't agree that the fines that they paid were fees for a cost of doing business. I'm not sure that I would imagine that's why you're here. Representative Wagenius, excuse me, you had a point to Representative Qualm's point. You raised your hand and I called on Representative Hansen. Representative Wagenius to Representative Qualm's point.
I think it would be interesting at some point, and we're not going to do that today, but to not speak in generalities, but just look at the specifics of permitting costs, what they pay for, and what we get for it, because one of the problems we're dealing with in the big picture is we haven't been able to protect our waters, and so now we're having to figure out what in the world we're going to do to protect our waters. So that's why we raised the 3/8 money to go back and fix some of the problems we didn't take care of because our permitting system didn't work. So those are probably longer discussions when maybe the 3/8 comes in, but there are clearly things that are not working, and we've got to figure out how to make them work. But the three citizens understand that, and they understand it well, and that's why they gave us the 3/8 money.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schumacher, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a very good bill. Members, I also sit on the Civil Law Committee, and Representative Westrom's got a bill that he's bringing forward. We heard it yesterday, and it it deals with agencies and these fees and the process by which judges brings a review of the process by which they bring forward these fines for people. And we've got in his bill, and he identified that there is some abuse at times by the agencies of people, and the scrutiny by which they bring forward these fines is not at a high level and not the level that needs to be. And that was some of the discussion in his bill. In that discussion, and the understanding was that many of the agencies, the fines actually go to the general fund, and that's by design so that the agency cannot be perceived as one in which they are generating funds for their mere existence. And so, Mr. Chair and members, I'm curious how many agencies do we have where the fees actually come back into the operating fund for the agency? I don't think that this is the norm. And I understand the Department of Agriculture, for sure the money goes to the general fund because I dealt with a constituent concern there, and I understand many of the others do as well. So this may be an anomaly in government.
Well, Representative Drazkowski, I don't see anybody from the DNR here today, but that would be a good question to ask the DNR. I don't know, Representative Hackbart or Representative Wagenius, do you guys know in some of the fines and fees that are like for taking of a trophy animal, do they go back into the game and fish funds or where they go? Representative Hackbart, do you know?
I'm not sure. I know that you have to deal with the local court system to get a tag for violation. But well, I don't know whether well, part of the money goes back to the DNR. I don't know.
Well, let's, Representative Drazkowski, I think especially in the agencies under our jurisdiction, that would be a good thing to find out. So I think in the case of Bowser, sometimes they have some action they need to take against folks and the DNR. As those people come forward over the next couple days, why don't we ask of that information, and staff can even forward that to Ms. Blackburn and Mr. Meyer so they can be working on an answer as we move forward.
Thank you,
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we need to remember that it is our responsibility, our function here, to make sure that the people are in control of the government and not the government in control of the people. And the design by which Representative Schumacher is proposing here to actually put the money into the general fund and remove it from the agency, I think is a best management practice that we, as legislators, we oversee this government is one that is a good one. Representative Schumacher, thank you for the bill.
Ms. Hallbeck, to that point, are there other fines within MPCA that would not be covered under Representative Schumacher's bill that would continue to go into dedicated funds?
Mr. Chair, yes. We also collect penalties and other reimbursements in our remediation fund. So when we're out on emergency response and spills have been found to be negligent, not accidental, those penalties come back into the remediation fund.
And Ms. Hallbeck, a lot of times, and those of us that have been in business or just personally have made the unfortunate mistake of maybe paying a tax a little bit late or forgetting to renew a license, there's sometimes some significant penalties involved in that, and I understand that. A lot of times you got the agencies maybe got to chase a person down, and I would say those are more incentives to get people to fill timely reports. So I understand where that there's additional costs within the agency when you got to track somebody down, so I understand that, but I was more specifically like fines, things that were of along that nature. Is there other ones in other funds too?
Mr. Chair, in our vernacular, a fine would be writing a ticket and being able to get the money directly. And we have a administrative process, and so we really do penalties or late fees. If you pay us late on your annual fee, then we would assess that. That does still come into the environmental fund.
Ms. Hallbeck, I'll have to warn you, when you use big words that are beyond my vocabulary, sometimes I get lost. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, I'm reading on the bill, line 1.8. So the section 115C05, what is that? Is that what provision is that that's getting the exception?
Ms. Hallbeck, I see you nodding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that is the statutory that references those penalties that go back into the remediation fund.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Representative Schumacher, so the remediation fund is, you don't want those dollars going into the general fund. Those should go back to the remediation fund. Is that the intent of the bill?
Representative Schumacher? I'm sorry, Representative Hansen, was that a question?
Yeah.
Representative Schumacher. Schumacher, I'm sorry. Is it Schumacher? I'm going back and forth.
I do the same thing, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, good. You're making me feel good. Representative Schumacher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the intent of the bill is to take the civil penalties that are created under here and credit them to the general fund instead of the environmental fund.
Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hallbeck, according to our House research paper, says the average amount of fines and penalties collected over the past 5 years averaged about $1.58 million. Could you give us a general breakdown prior to 2009 when this was changed, how that money was divided up between the going back to your agency and then also going to the general fund? How was that divided up prior to 2009?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, each of the members should have a handout on their desk, and that provides you a history since fiscal year 2002 on how the split occurred between the general fund and the environmental fund. So the cap into the environmental fund was roughly $650,000. It varied a little above that, a little bit below that. And then the variation for the general fund was as low as $219,000 and as large as $950,000.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, can you give me a sense for how the dollar amounts are arrived at on the fines? Is there a set schedule? Is it something that's kind of a variable floating? Is it negotiated?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, I think I would like to turn that question over to Jeff Connell, one of our enforcement managers who really works with the staff to set that up.
Okay, that sounds good. Mr. Connell, I believe it was. Could you identify yourself for the record and who you're with?
Sure, Jeff Connell, Manager, Compliance and Enforcement, the Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome, Mr. Connell.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, member, our penalties are arrived at not by a specific formula, but a set of criteria found in statute where we look at specific things such as how bad it was, the gravity of the violation, how long it went on for, how much pollution was emitted, or what the possible potential for harm might have been had the release actually occurred. So we take those kind of site-specific things that happen on any given instance, and we look at kind of applying, you know, what have we done in other similar situations? What did the company possibly gain economically by not doing it right? And we look at all of those factors, and then we arrive at kind of a penalty to begin to sit down with the company and then work out what a settlement might be. Because really 99% or more of our penalties are just simply settlements that we reach with people. So I think that we go back to the vernacular word, meaning that a fine is something that feels like it's more set by a rule or a statute where you went too fast and you ended up paying $120. A penalty is something we arrive at more looking at specific considerations and criteria, but each one will change based on what happened on site. It's not a specific formula.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you don't reach a settlement with the polluter, then what happens? If you don't reach an agreement in your discussions with whoever the entity is that's in negotiations with you, then what happens?
Mr. Connell.
Mr. Chair, member, there's a number of different options if we don't reach settlement. And, of course, one of those options is that we can proceed with a lawsuit in district court and essentially sue over the violations. At that point, we are then asking the court to calculate a penalty. We don't calculate it ourselves anymore. The statute prescribes what the maximum penalties can be per day per violation, and we simply give that to the court. We say, you decide, and then, of course, we kind of argue about the facts of what happened. You know, because most of the programs that we administer have federal delegation or federal rules and regulations behind them, another option for us is, as part of our work with EPA, is we ask EPA if they're interested in taking the case if settlement can't be reached at the state level. And on rare occasion, we do that as well. And sometimes if a company is no longer viable or no longer in the business, sometimes settlement doesn't happen and the enforcement case doesn't go forward at all.
Thank you,
Mr. Three of the more common.
Thank you, Mr. Connell. You talked about how sometimes the agency will measure the damages to assess the fine. Aren't sometimes the fines assessed by the profit that the person you're assessing generated because of their action, and the fine's not necessarily related to what damage may be to the environment, but it may have been what the economic gain was to the permittee in maybe manufacturing more ethanol. We actually limit how many gallons of ethanol they can be permitted for, and if the price of ethanol goes up, we don't let them make more ethanol so they make more money. We tell them you can only make so much, and if they go over that amount for whatever reason, don't we sometimes assess them based on the profit they made, not on necessarily what the damage was?
Mr. Chair, without getting into too much detail, I'll get to the specific question. Our penalties are composed of essentially three different groups of factors, one being kind of the environmental piece about how much pollution was released or how long did it go on for. The second major group would just be adjustments that we might make related to have they been in trouble with us before, how long has it been since they were in trouble. And the third is the piece you refer to, which we call economic benefit. We're not necessarily against profit or after profit. What we're after is making sure that a company didn't gain economically from the violations that occurred at the facility. We have the concept of level playing field and stuff that we take pretty seriously when we look at whatever penalty might be appropriate. So on your specific example, say with the ethanol overproduction, We have permits that people come in and apply for, and they say, we'll make 49 million gallons a year, and that's all that we're asking for. And so we go through the public process, we issue that permit, they go through environmental review, and then once that permit's in place, that's how many million gallons a year the public has expected them to produce. So in the ethanol example, if they make 3, 4, 5 million gallons more per year, we ask them, after all of your costs, after all of your expenses related to operation, what was your net profit that you made only on those gallons you produced beyond what you were permitted to? And from that, we were able to derive what their economic benefit from the overproduction might have been. And so that was one third of the component of their penalties.
Thank you. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, have you had any input? Have you consulted with any of the groups that might be interested in this bill? I'm thinking, you know, there are a number of sportsmen's organizations, for instance, that I think have interest in the environmental fund and the work that it does. The Chamber of Commerce, have you consulted with any interested parties in putting this bill together? Have you had any feedback from any interested parties?
Representative Schumacher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I have not consulted with the Chamber of Commerce on this. I have consulted with my local constituents on this issue, and they are in favor of such action.
Representative Hilty, follow up.
Not a follow up to that question, Mr. Chair, but a question for you. You mentioned earlier about a spike in collections with ethanol production that I think you referred to as millions of dollars. When did that occur, Mr. Chair? Because I'm looking at the numbers that we have in the handout from PCA, and they seem pretty uniform. There's a bit of a spike in 2010, but that's about a $600,000 spike, and I'm not seeing any millions of dollars. Did that occur before 2002?
Representative Hilty and Ms. Hallback, or Mr. Connell, can you tell me how the fines specific to the ethanol industry have changed? Because this fine schedule that you've given us includes much more than the ethanol industry. If I Representative Hilty's question revolves around just the ethanol industry part of those fines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, the fines related to ethanol, as Ms. Hallback spoke to, generally originate about a year before the actual fine penalty would be, you know, assessed and any money would come into the environmental fund. The change that occurred was really due to the rapid growth of the industry. There were simply many more facilities made in 05, 06, 07 that came online. The key violation that resulted in that larger economic benefit of overproduction, which is kind of the theme here, was based on a one-year production average that they had to keep track of each month. So really, until they had been fully constructed and operational for a year, we didn't know how many millions of gallons per year they were actually going to produce. So taking that delay, as well as the fact that our own administrative process to settle one of these penalties can take, on average, about a year, there was considerable timeline between when these penalties were first identified and when they actually came in the door. Most of the penalties from the spike in 09 and 10 were really the result of inspections in 08 and earlier 09.
Mr. Connell, you haven't answered the question. How big were the fines in 7, 8, and 9 with the ethanol industry? Just if you have a rough idea. If I'm not mistaken, they were not very big and all of a sudden were pretty large with the ethanol industry. That's the question.
Mr. Chair, I don't have exact figures, so I mean, I don't want to guess.
Mr. Cannell, I'm a landscaper. We just keep it simple.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, so in 08, we started having the larger penalties come in. We had penalties in the dollar amounts of $300,000, $425,000. They did go up with a couple of additional facilities in 09 and 10 into the lower millions.
What were they in 07?
I don't have 07 figures in front of me, Mr. Chair.
What were they in 06, 05, 04, 03, 02?
One moment.
You're okay. If you don't have them, you can get back to us. If I'm not mistaken, they're relatively low.
They're
Why don't you get back to us with how they relate to the ethanol industry?
Sure, Mr.
That was
Chair.
Representative Hilty's question. Go ahead, Mr. Cannell.
They are relatively low.
Thank you.
It's just that I don't have the exact.
That's okay. You can. There's nothing wrong with being honest. Representative Hilty. Good. Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannell, in regarding the fines and your interaction with companies that are fined, do you have a sense, I'm just looking for a point of clarification here, of do they have insurance to cover these fines generally? Is this a cost of doing business kind of a thing? Or what, do you have any information on that?
Mr. Cannell or Ms. Hallback?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have any specific information about their insurance coverage. I do know that, for example, there was a tax law change a number of years ago that didn't allow them to write them off anymore. So I don't know if it's a cost of doing business or not, or if they cover it in other areas. The numbers that we used in order to determine how much money they were making, we asked each individual facility to give to us so that each one was making a different amount of money after their expenses, and those are the numbers we use to determine what would be appropriate for economic benefit.
And Mr. Cannell, in most of those, if not all, were settled out of court. You and the permittee made an agreement, right, and they paid the fine based on a negotiated settlement with your agency?
Mr. Chair, they were all settled out of court, yes.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd What just curious is if this ends up being a legal back and forth between insurance attorneys and your office, legal folks, and perhaps our Attorney General's office.
Representative Draskowski, were you looking for an answer? They were
please.
Looking like Mr. Cannell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the most part, we don't have to get in the middle of that battle, but I am sure those battles occur for some of these penalties when they're assessed.
Follow-up, Representative Purcell. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that, Representative Purcell. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannell, I know that in some other departments, and I particularly have a case I followed a year ago with the Department of Agriculture, as I mentioned earlier, and you alluded to it a little bit in your presentation, but it seems there are times when actually there aren't any identifiable damages that would or have happened to the environment, but rather some situations where, in the judgment of the agencies, there would have been potential for damages or could have happened. Are those situations and the times in which those people are fined for something in the eyes of the agency could potentially have been a problem for the environment? Is that a significant amount of the number of fines that you bring forward and penalties? I guess that would be the question, Mr.
Chair. Cannell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, most of our programs are preventative in nature. It's our rules and our positions and our permits are written to prevent damage to the environment. So when those situations occur that have that great potential for harm, really whether actual harm has happened or not, those are situations where we pursue the violations and the penalties for. It would be hard for me to tell you exactly how many, but I would say the majority of our cases involve going assessing penalties related to those situations where a preventative program is in place, some actions occurred, there was a certain potential for harm. It varies with every situation. And for those situations, there are penalties that get assessed.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Draskowski.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cannell, So the minority of situations then are situations where there was actually any harm to the environment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Connell.
Mr. Chair, Representative. It's correct to say, because our preventative programs are looking at trying to get to these situations of non-compliance before there's actually an environment.
But Mr. Connell, if I can do a follow-up to that, if you give an ethanol plant a permit for, I think you used a number of 50 million, or I don't know if that's a gallon, say it is, just use the number. That permit's based on a number of things that you've determined, the water that they're going to need to take out of the environment, or the amount of dust that's going to be created by the trucks coming and going. Some of that would be hard to measure in an immediate case if they go beyond that permit level. And so isn't that the rationale of why you do the fine on an economic impact? I mean, you can't measure exactly. I mean, they used more water to create more. I don't want to sound like I'm justifying it, because I don't necessarily agree with when you really go major league on these fines. But isn't that the rationale for where you're coming from? You can't immediately measure some of that, but you worked a permit out with them, and they've exceeded that permit. I would argue not always even knowing they exceeded until after the fact. And if we were a little more proactive working with people, we'd be better off. But isn't that where you're coming from, some of the logic on it, I hope?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Most of the time we're not able to get directly at what the potential for harm or actual harm may have been.
Or if there was any.
Correct, such as your example. But we do use these surrogate parameters, right, kind of to, if you were permitted to make 50 million gallons and you made 5 million more, there was 5 million more gallons worth of pollution released into the air or the water used. We may not be able to just whip out the calculator and know exactly what that might be, but that was more than what you were permitted to be producing.
Follow-up, Representative Jaskowski?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I do have a better understanding now. Mr. Connell, thank you. And it sounds like, at least in this area, our government is actually fining people for situations where they actually didn't harm the environment, as I suspected. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. To this point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is to this point. I find this kind of fascinating, because if we substitute corporation for person, I mean, and permit license for permit, I mean, I have a driver's license where I take an exam to determine a minimum competency, and if I speed, the faster I speed, the more penalty I get because of the potential for an accident. So the enforcement is based on a knowledge that I had when I got the license, that I'd have knowledge on what the law is. And here we have this discussion about penalties relating to corporations versus person penalties and the responsibility of a person. So I'd like to see on this point, Mr. Chair, if we can look at how some of the public safety person crimes are dealt with. It seems like they are based on the potential of harm or actual. If we take a game and fish, we assign a penalty based on the value that's been assigned to the number of fish that have been illegally harvested. So I think there's a lot of precedent out there in terms of dealing with violations and penalties. But if I speed, I don't get the opportunity. I suppose I do have the opportunity to settle. I could get a lawyer and fight that speeding ticket. The more I speed, if I do speed, would be based on the potential of the accident or the consequence that could come from that.
Representative Hilty, to this point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Jaskowski's point, I actually operated a manufacturing business for 35 years that involved the use of hazardous chemicals, in part. And we took great care to make sure that they were handled properly. If you have a 55-gallon drum of some toxic substance, You want to make sure that you don't have it sitting on a loading dock where it could be stabbed by a fork in your forklift. I would have thought that if we had handled the materials in a careless way and PCA or OSHA or someone came along and said, you have created the potential for a very serious accident here, you should know better than that. You should take precautions not to allow situations like this. They would have been totally justified in doing that. I understood what the hazards were, and I did everything that I could to deal with them. But if somebody was going to point out to me that I had created a situation that had great potential for harm, I think I would have actually appreciated knowing that before it actually occurred.
Representative Drazkowski, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilty, and you know, I understand what you're saying, but there are times at which, in situations I've run across, in which the individual actually doesn't know exactly what that they're in violation of something. The farmer I talked about earlier had a bunker silo. He hauled in his own urea. He stored it in a bunker silo. He covered it up with plastic. There was absolutely, this is Representative Hansen's old bailiwick where he used to work, but he wasn't aware of the storage laws against bulk storage, Representative Hansen. He did everything upon being discovered by the agency, in that case it was the Department of Agriculture, that they asked him to do. He cleaned it out, he spread it out on his cropland, he swept it out with a broom. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever of any fertilizer being leached out or anything. The tarp didn't leak. He did exactly what he was supposed to do, and guess what? He got a $5,000 fine. And so at some point, these agencies have the ability to go beyond, I think, what the people are expecting, and running over individuals and businesses who intend to do no harm to the environment, believe they aren't putting any potential for harm out there. And in some cases, and certainly I believe the one that I described to you, there wasn't any potential for harm to the environment. But guess what? He still got a fine.
We're going to try and get moving here. Representative Hilty, comment? Representative Wagenius, you had a comment to Representative Drazkowski's earlier comment. Representative Wagenius.
Actually, I had a question for the witnesses.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Wagenius, question for the witness. I'll let you jump in as long as you're on. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about having a permit for a certain amount, when somebody applied for that permit, then I'm assuming that an environmental assessment worksheet was done if it was under a certain gallon amount, but that they would have to have an EIS if it was over a certain gallon amount. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gordon. Connell, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't work directly in environmental review, but yes, I believe you're correct in that.
Representative Wagenius.
And it's my understanding, secondly, that a number of people applied for gallons just under the limit so they could avoid EISs. And so once they've avoided an EIS, then they overproduce. Am I correct about that?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, there are thresholds both in permits and in the environmental review, and the project proposer gets to select what they intend to do as a project. And yes, sometimes they're below an environmental review threshold, whether it be a municipality or an industry, and sometimes it's below the threshold for an EIS. All of those, whether they're environmental review environmental impact statement or just coming in for the permit all encompass an estimate of what you're going to produce and what you're going to discharge and whether it can be done in the environment.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chair, my line of questioning is going to go even further off the track of the bill, but perhaps I'll drop my own bill in, which will set up an opportunity to talk even further about this subject. This is fascinating to hear about how they find, why they find, what public purpose is served, if any. And I think it's this is the kind of debate I love engaging in around these kind of issues. So my line of questioning I will withhold until I think I drop my own bill.
We look forward to your bill, Representative Beard. Representative Hansen, did I cross your name out? Are you good? You're good? Okay. Representative Anderson, you want to renew your motion that House File 185, or he will renew his motion that House File 185 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hackbart, we've got Representative Hackbart's out. We're going to first hear, he's got House File 434, I believe. The folks from the petroleum, Mr. Krogman, do you want to come down? Are you going to speak about the bill? I'll move Representative House File 434. Oh, wait a minute. I got the wrong one. Did it again. You believe it? I got to put my glasses on, members. We got House File 197. Hackbart, we're going to need Hackbart here for that. Is he out in the hall? Somebody want to grab him? Representative Hackbart's got House File 197. Non-resident off-road vehicle state trail pass required. I believe Mr. Gunderson, you're in the audience, so you should be ready to speak. I don't know, no Hackbart anywhere. Okay, great. We're going to reverse. Sure. Sir, I'm going to ask you to sit down again. Krogman, come on back. We're going to start it. Hey, Bob. Let's start 434. I know something about that bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm the second author on that bill. I'd be happy to move it.
Representative Hilty, you're saving me. Thank you. Mr. Krogman, let's see. Representative Hilty is going to move House File 434 for possible inclusion. He's your second author. Representative Hackbart, you're both moving your bill. I don't know if that's allowed, but you both just moved it. Representative Hackbart, to your bill. Some way, somehow, we just bumped 434 in front of 197. I hope
that's
you're
fine,
okay
Mr.
with
Chairman,
that.
Thank you very much. I think we've heard a little bit about this in this committee already. The bill's been through a couple committees already. And I have Mr. Bob Krogman here with me today to give testimony on the bill. And we have other people in the audience from the departments and that can answer any questions that you may have. But I think it's pretty much to the point. It just extends out the sunset of the petrol fund.
And it's the blink on, blink off, 2 cents. That we've had a number of discussion already in committee, so I appreciate, Representative Hackbart, you not repeating all that. Mr. Krogman, you've been down and testify on this issue before. Do you have anything to add to your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. I would answer any questions, but I don't have any.
Members, questions for Representative Hackbart or Mr. Krogman? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krogman or Representative Hackbarth, you know, you've heard my concerns before about there being some at least indirect nexus between motor vehicle activity and this tax. I know we need to keep in sort of the insurance program in effect for our petroleum marketing people. And I'm also concerned that there had been a rumor of a move to divert additional funds into something other than cleaning up leaking fuel tanks or monitoring leaking fuel tanks. Can you talk about whether this just does that or is there something else that they're extending this into or setting this up for something else?
Mr. Krogman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I'm not quite sure what you mean by diversion of funds.
Mr. Krogman, I think that would be a question not for,
probably for
an interest
author.
Group. It would be more for the legislature, I believe.
Yes.
Representative, do you have any comment on that, Representative Hackbart?
That's certainly not my intent, Mr. Chairman, to have something like that happen.
So, Mr. Thank you,
Chairman,
Representative Hackbart. Representative Beard, follow up.
This merely extends the sunset date. That's what this bill does.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, the second part of the bill allows those folks who collect and store used oil for ultimate sale at retail to go over the threshold of $1 million or million gallons of coverage. When the petrol fund was first adopted, that pet threshold was put in there so the fund would not be drained, if you want, cleaning up pipeline terminals and refineries. Since then, used oil collection of it has consolidated. The folks who collect used oil now, they have tanks in city garages, counties, city offices where do-it-yourselfers can deposit their oil. They collect oil all year long. They sell it in the summer to hot mix plants. That's the only real market for it. And they end up storing more, carrying over more than they used to, coupled with their storage of refined fuels, gasoline and diesel. They can go over that million gallons threshold. That's why that portion is in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further follow-up, Representative Beard?
That's what I was fishing for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
I think we're good. Members, we'll hold over House File 434 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Krogman. Representative Hackbart, you've got House File 197.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And I believe you have a simple author's amendment. Do you want to...
Yeah, I'd move House File 197 be held over for possible inclusion.
And do you want to offer an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, line 2.5, it says the commissioner may. I'd like to change the may to shall. Remove may and insert shall.
Ms. Taylor, do you have the amendment? She's got it. Okay. Any discussion to Representative Hackbart's amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendments adopted. Representative Hackbart, the bill's in the shape you'd like. You want to let us know what your bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. This bill has to do with off-road vehicles and creating an off-road vehicle non-resident trail pass for four-wheel drive trucks on four-wheel drive truck trails in the state of Minnesota. For a number of years now, snowmobiles have had a non-resident trail pass. When non-residents come to Minnesota, they buy a non-resident snowmobile pass, a trail pass. And a few years ago, I did the same thing for ATVs. When you come to Minnesota and you bring your ATV, there's now a non-resident ATV trail pass. And the folks from the Four-Wheel Drive Association came to me, and they would like to do the same thing when people bring their four-wheel drive trucks to Minnesota that go on the trails. Right now, to be legal, you have to register them in the state of Minnesota, and we would like to just make a trail pass so they can just acquire a trail pass, either an annual pass or a three-year pass, and they can go on the trails, the four-wheel drive truck trails in the state of Minnesota. I have with me today Mr. Bruce Gunderson with the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association, and he can answer any questions for you. And I think you'd like to give a little introduction also, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gunderson, please introduce yourself and let us know what you have
Mr.
to say.
Chair, committee members, my name is Bruce Gunderson. I am the current president of the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association, and we are seeking to have this bill entered into law to enable the tourists, the casual visitor to our state, to travel at the trails. Currently, they have to register their vehicles as we do, go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, register their vehicle, get a sticker. Those licensing agents are only open from 8 to 5 weekdays, not weekends, not holidays. This bill would allow it to move over to the DNR for licensing purposes, and you can go to convenience stores and get your off-road sticker that way. It greatly eases the registration process for the casual tourists coming to our state. I'm open to questions. Thank you.
Representative Hackbart, did you want Mr. Potter to come down, or does anybody need to hear from the DNR? What's their position on it, Representative Hackbart?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what the department's position is. I don't think they oppose the bill. They've not come to me. I don't believe they oppose it. I think it would probably bring more money into the account if this trail pass was available. Rather than having vehicles register in the state of Minnesota, this would be much easier for folks to come here and recreate, and a $20 trail pass is easier to buy.
Seems to be a no-nonsense thing. Mr. Potter, why don't you come down while Representative Fabian asks his question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbarth, is just
pass available to be bought at a local DMV, or is it going to be strictly through the DNR?
Representative Hackbert. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Gunderson, didn't you say it would be available through ELS? And Mr. Potter, why don't you answer Representative Fabian's question and then give us the DNR's position on the bill. Introduce yourself. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Potter. I'm with the Parks and Trails Division. Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, this change would make those permits available at ELS locations around the state. So they're available basically 24/7.
And the department's position on the bill?
We have no concerns with the bill, sir.
Okay, so you support the bill?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative, is that good? Representative Fabian, it'll be available at ELS. So, oh, that's everywhere. That's a convenience store, the DNR. That's everywhere. So somebody going up to the Boabic comes from Wisconsin on a weekend, they'll be able to go into the what do you call it, center? The Boabic. Well, you can go to the Boabic. What do you call the place where they go off-road in the old pit there?
Iron Range. Or you eat at the Gilbert?
Yeah.
Iron Range off highway vehicle.
Thank recreation. You, Representative Hackbart. I guess I got to be more organized. People think I'm running. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see, Representative Hackbart, Mr. Potter, that this pays for the cost of the license itself. Does this fee, along with the rest of the fees, sufficient amount of money to pay for taking care of the trails?
Mr. Potter, can you tell us how much is in trail accounts, maybe? And to Representative Lucinius's question, does the money pay for the trails, and how's it used?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucinius, currently the fund is solvent. There's about $1 million that's coming into the account annually, and it remains solvent through the next 5 years. So then that funds the grant and aid program as well as our administration of the program.
Representative Wagenius, follow up.
Okay. So you feel, Mr. Potter, Representative McNamara, that this is enough money to take care of the trails? Is this also enough money for enforcement?
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, enforcement is also part of that funding currently, and we haven't seen any requests for change items. I think that's adequate as well.
Mr. Potter, if I'm not mistaken, it's just a little different. We're talking the 4x4 trucks here, but I had a discussion yesterday with one of the ATV users, and when I renew my ATV, I think it's $45 for 3 years or something like that. But a significant part of the fee I pay goes right to enforcement to go after those people that maybe aren't doing the right thing, or to educate those of us that may not know what the right thing is. And was it a significant part of these fees that we collect go over to the Enforcement Division of DNR, do they not?
Mr. Chairman, that's true, especially in the ATV program, but there's a lot more trails there. For the ORVs, we have 23 miles of designated trails in the state, plus a couple riding areas. So enforcement, as well as the department, gets substantially less money to maintain those trails.
Mr. Potter,
it's a much smaller system.
Excuse me. Mr. Potter, any of those riding areas located in southern Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, there is one in Appleton that's kind of southwest.
Thank you. Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the point about enforcement, I attended an ATV summit, I think it was called. I'm not a legislative summit this last Saturday up in Alexandria. And we had some facts there. I think maybe it came from the department, where even though we have more enforcement, we have more people on the trail, ATVs, dirt bikes, and four-wheel drive trucks. We have more participants. We have more enforcement out there. The amount of tags and violations is way down, and that's very impressive.
And Representative Hackbart, I also, in my discussion with this ATV user, he made mention of how they want to keep a significant amount of money. It's in a fund that's for restoration.
Correct.
And that fund is growing because the amount of restoration that the DNR has been able to attribute to the actual ATV damage they're putting in more than they're finding damage, but the ATV users want to make sure that there's enough in that fund so that we do fix the bad situations that happen. And I know they really did a good job, ATVAM did in Hastings, when we had significant trouble at the wildlife management area by going after some bad users. So I've been impressed with these organizations and how they're working with Mr. Potter. We have, I believe, two DNR officials, COs, one of them up in Grand Rapids and maybe New Ulm or somewhere, I'm not exactly sure, but two across the state that their main job is working with ATVs and the off-road situation. So it's one that I think we learned from the snowmobiles decades ago how to work with these different interest groups. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a question for you about process. The bill that we have before us has a fee increase. We still have the law on the books that define a fee as a tax, which I presume means that if this bill advances either on its own or as part of an omnibus bill, it would require being heard in a tax committee. I'm not understanding how the process is going to work here. Just theoretically, if this bill and others like it are incorporated in the omnibus finance bill that comes out of this committee, would it then move to taxes, or how is that going to work?
Representative Hilty, I'm not exactly sure what the past process has been if we include a fee of this size on a group like this, but I'll be glad to ask Representative Davids where he's at on that, and I don't know if Representative Wagenius can add if something like this, I'm not sure, Representative Hackbart, if we're talking Mr. Potter, I mean, are we talking about 10, 20 non-resident vehicles that are going to come in? And so if I'm not mistaken, there's a protocol here when we're talking about something under $2,000, or I don't know what. Mr. Potter, have you ever had, how many requests have you had from non-resident that want a trail pass for 4x4s?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't had a lot of requests, but it hasn't really been an option. But this really isn't a fee increase. If they were going to register, they would pay the same amount. This is just a different way for them to register.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Potter. Further questions? Representative Qualm, no, you pass.
That was the question.
Oh, you guys are on the same process. Way to go. Representative Hackbart, you want to renew your motion to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, we'll lay over House File 197. Representative Hackbart, House File 824.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move to House File 824, and we're going to hold that over, too, I believe. Is that correct?
Representative Hackbart, we are. You want to just tell us what the bill is? And
okay.
Then
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is Metropolitan Parks, Metropolitan Regional Parks funding bill. This is a line item in the governor's budget. And if you look at the bill, it's $3,213,000 in 2012 and 2013. And which is substantially less than last biennium, but still a little bit more than what the governor recommended, I believe. But I have with me today a gentleman from Three Rivers Parks District that can tell us a little bit more about the bill and maybe run through the presentation that we have.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Please identify yourself for the record. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Bo Carlson. I'm the Associate Superintendent for Three Rivers Park District. On behalf of all the 10 Metropolitan Parks implementing agencies, I want to thank you for your consideration of House File 824 and thank Representative Hackbart for carrying this legislation. I believe we do have a handout that hopefully has been included in your packets or everybody should have within their packets, and I wanted to run just through a little bit of background on what the Metro Regional Park System is, how long we've been in existence, and what are the types of things that we do within the system, and particularly how we use this funding to achieve the goals of the Metro Regional Park System. If you look at page 2, the system was established by law in the state of Minnesota in 1974. Although many of our implementing agencies were established much prior to that, this was essentially the collection of all the 10 Metropolitan Park agencies coming together to to recognize that we would act and serve as the state park system within the metropolitan area. The goal was to not duplicate those park services, not create a state park system in the metro area and a state park system in greater Minnesota, but essentially have the metro region act as that state park entity within the metropolitan, the seven county metropolitan area. With that, over the years, we've developed and are now at a point where we have roughly 55,000 acres in the form of 58 different parks and park reserves within the system. We have 38 miles of regional trail and 231 miles of trail that are open to the public for use. Probably the most significant piece that we've seen, and we've stated this many times, we have 38 million visitors that come to the Metro Regional Park System. If you look at the Explore Minnesota information and data that they receive on the various tourist destinations, we're second only to the Mall of America as far as visits. And certainly those numbers are trending up. Since 2004, we've seen an increase of almost 15% of our visitation. So folks are staying closer to home, they're recreating in the regional system, they're using our regional trails, they're using our facilities. So who owns and manages the Metro Regional Park System? We're made up of 10 different implementing agencies. It's the seven counties in the metro area, the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Three Rivers Park District, who represents essentially Hennepin County, and then the city of Bloomington as well. When we were established, there was also the creation of Minnesota Statute 473.351, and this gets to the partnership that's been in the relationship between the Metro Regional System and the state of Minnesota. There's a recognition that most of the visitation within the Metro Regional Systems comes outside of our taxing jurisdiction. So those county park systems, those city park systems that we have that make up the regional system, many of our visitors, up to 40% of our visitation, is outside of our taxing jurisdiction. So how can we then distribute those funds to provide support to the systems that are seeing the greatest amount of pressure? That statutory formula was developed to provide that opportunity to redistribute those funds within the metro area and provide the needed state support that we have for our ongoing day-to-day operations and maintenance. And that formula essentially identifies things like visitation, our park budgets that we have, and the acreage that we manage and maintain. Probably most significantly, if you turn to the next page, is that it's stated in that same legislation that each implementing agency must receive no less than 40% of its actual operation and maintenance expense to be incurred in the current calendar year budget. And that's significant, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the presentation. Our actual support that we receive for operations and maintenance is made up of two separate funds. We get lottery in lieu of proceeds, which is a dedicated account. That's fairly static, although it does fluctuate based on the amount of ticket sales, lottery ticket sales that happen in a particular year. Secondarily, we get general fund support, and that's provided to the agencies, again, based on those factors that were identified. As was mentioned in the opening presentation, our current level, we received $3.5 million in general fund support for the system. The bill that's in front of you today would actually reduce that amount by $357,000 to a level of $3.2 million. The governor's recommendation was actually reducing that amount by $1.4 million, so it was almost a 40% reduction of where we traditionally have been in operations and maintenance funding. And again, looking at that previous statutory language that we talked about, where up to 40% or a minimum of 40% should be provided for that regional system, when you look at the system costs, and this is the projected system cost of the budgets of each of those agencies combined into one, based on what we're currently receiving, we're getting about 10% of those dollars. And the difference then is made up by each local agency through our property taxes, through fees that we charge for park visitors, or different activities we have within our parks. And you'll notice as recently as 2001, we were as high as 17% of those costs that were being collected. We've seen a steady decline since that kind of high water mark that we had in 2001. By contrast, at the same time, we've seen a tremendous increase in our visitation. So we're kind of having two things happen. We're reducing the operations and maintenance support that we receive on a regular basis, and we're receiving more visitation, which is putting a lot more pressure on our parks. We're getting more folks that are showing up, more need for just the day-to-day maintenance that goes on within our facilities, trail maintenance, trail patrol, being out there guarding our beaches, seasonal staff, those types of things that happen on a regular basis. The next page actually talks to what the impact would actually be for each particular agency within the system. Again, looking at that formulaic distribution, this gives you an idea of what each agency would be hit with if we were to look at the various proposals. One, the governor's recommendation, and then secondarily, House File 824. And looking at that again, a reduction of $1.4 million based on the governor's recommendation and a reduction of $357,000 based on House File 24. In closing, just a couple of very quick points. The Metro Regional System has had a significant amount of state and regional investment made to it since 1974, since its creation. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars that's been put in capital development through the bonding program, the LCCMR, and now legacy funding. Really, the operations and maintenance support we receive protects that investment. It allows us to keep our facilities in good shape, to keep those dollars that were invested by the state in good standing. So this is really, again, protecting some of that investment that's made traditionally throughout the years. Secondarily, we certainly and absolutely recognize the difficult financial position the state of Minnesota is in. And what we're looking at, again, is a reduction off of our current system that we're at, the 10% reduction. Our concern is that the 40% recommendation made by the governor seems disproportionately high when you look at some of the agencies that are also providing the same types of services that we're doing, things like the DNR, Bowser, or PCA. We're concerned that this level of reduction would have a tremendous impact on what we do day to day, and that would be felt by our users that are out in our system more than ever.
Thank
and
you,
with Mr. that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Hackbart, I'm just wondering, is somebody here from Met Council that could speak to the governor's 40% cut? I guess they're not here. Questions for Mr. Carlson or Representative Hackbart. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm remembering some testimony previously. I think it was Mr. Hornstein, Representative Hornstein's bill about Minneapolis wanting to add a surcharge or tax on new construction to go towards parks. But in that, there was quite a bit of information and testimony about Minneapolis and St. Paul and the metro area having a very high density of parks and you know, compared to other metro areas. And I'm looking at the funding you have here, and I think you've got some very good facilities, but does this funding then mean that you won't be getting any money from the DNR in additional to this? For regional parks, does this mean that there won't be any legacy funds? Because I seem to recall there's been a history of 40-some-odd percent of the legacy fund money going to the metro, you know, Metropolitan Council and the metro parks, and those areas still being able to get part of the, 20 or less percent that is statewide granted out. And I'm, you know, looking, you say, you know, fairness between the governor's hit to you compared to other agencies. And I'm looking at, I think the last time Greater Minnesota received, 12% compared to the designated 40-some percent. And then, you know, a good portion of the statewide, you know, let alone DNR. So I'm trying to understand this little bit of money. Well, I apologize to my constituents. A few million dollars is not a little bit of money. But how are the other funding streams, you know, legacy fund, DNR, etc., impact your budget?
Mr. Carlson, if I could just, for members, a lot of what Representative Qualm was talking about was the legacy money. The legacy money, I think, last time was divided up. The parks and trails money was divided up a percentage, 40-some percent for state parks, 40-some percent for metro parks, which is the list that Mr. Carlson has included, who's all part of that. And then there was a third pot of money in legacy that went throughout the state, and I believe it was in the low teens, 14%. That was a competitive grant that Greater Minnesota got 80% of those grants. They were competitive throughout the state. The legacy money is paid 64% by the citizens that live in the seven county metropolitan area, and 36% by the citizens that live in greater Minnesota. So a lot of Representative Quam was talking about the legacy money, which we will get to have lots of talk about. He did ask Mr. Carlson about other funds that Metro Parks get from DNR or the state of Minnesota, if you could comment on that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And in the last appropriation of the legacy funding that was provided, I think it's safe to say most every agency within the metro area used those dollars for more capital improvement type projects. The difference between the operations and maintenance funding that we have, maybe to simplify it and maybe in fact oversimplify it, the potholes that we may have in the trail, the general fund support and operations and maintenance funding fills that pothole. The legacy dollars and the bonding dollars we've received in the past overlays and builds the whole new trail that might happen within a park or a regional trail that might be out there. As far as other funding sources that we receive, as I mentioned, we receive a little bit of LCCMR funding, particularly for park acquisition within the metropolitan area. Beyond that, we do not receive any other funding from the Department of Natural Resources. Again, most of our agency budgets are supported by local property taxes and fees that we charge for park activities or park facilities.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to, I'm new to the process, and so all of these things being laid over for possible inclusion, a certain number of those that I don't end up agreeing with will cause me to not vote for an omnibus bill that includes them.
Representative Quam, you'll get a chance when we do our omnibus bill. You'll have a chance if there's parts of the omnibus bill that you don't like, you can offer amendments to delete those, and then the body here will get a chance to vote on them. So if there's things that we include in our omnibus bill that you don't like, you'll certainly have a chance to discuss those. And then when we get done, like all the members, you'll have a chance to vote yes or no on any of the bills that come before the committee, for sure. Further discussion? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, thank you for being here. You mentioned fees as part of your income stream. Could you give us a brief description of what kind of fee income you have? I assume those are user fees generated from the folks that use your parks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that is correct. We have, at least within the Three Rivers Park District system, and I think we're consistent with most all the agencies, we have a variety of fees for particular user activities, whether that's boat launches in some instances. It might be camping fees, reservation fees, picnicking fees for some of our pavilions that we have. Some of the agencies also operate things like golf courses that are outside of the regional park system, but most of the revenue that we collect in those facilities we dedicate back to our general fund to offset some of those costs. We have ski pass fees for cross-country skiing in some of our systems. And in addition to that, some of our facilities or some of our agencies charge gate fees. So to actually enter in the park, you pay a gate fee, a daily fee, or an annual pass for whatever that system might be.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, so those gate fees are not consistent. You mentioned that you were the state park system for the metro area. I know when I go to the state park, any state park, I either have a sticker on my windshield or buy a sticker for the day or a couple of days. Is that the case in these metro parks?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, some of our agencies do charge gate fees. The difficulty is some of our agencies as well, like Minneapolis or St. Paul, where you have facilities like the Chain of Lakes, which is probably one of the most popular facilities within the metro regional park system. There isn't a controlled access point where there's only one way to get in and or out of that particular park. So you have users that may go down, walk around Lake Calhoun or Lake of the Isles. They can park in a city street, walk to that trail, walk around that park, and spend the day or the afternoon at the park. There isn't a controlled entrance point. So for other agencies, it does become a little bit more of a challenge to charge that entrance fee for every user that comes within the system. But some agencies do have gate fees.
Apologize for the noise. We cannot figure out where it's coming from. So if somebody's listening, we are trying to see what it is. I think I have Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, you're familiar with where we're at in our state budget situation. Somebody is. What are your long-term plans, your contingency plans? Should this general fund money go away, what would you do?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, that would be, again, for each of our agencies to determine what those impacts will be. Looking at the governor's recommendation, those are fairly significant. We would have to look at staffing reductions, whether that's seasonal or full-time staff, potential facility closures, whether that's our park visitor centers or different locations where we just have to reduce some of those impacts, delaying just some of the day-to-day maintenance that we do on an everyday basis. So picking up facilities, patrolling trails, cleaning up trails, those types of things, as well as natural resource restoration projects. Most of our, or all of our parks are a natural resource-based park system. Where the big expanses of open space and land that are in the metro region. So it would have to be reduced restoration that we're doing, reduced invasive species control that we're trying to deal with on a regular basis. Those are just some of the things that we have to consider.
Thank Mr. Chief,
Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
And Mr. Carlson, thank you for having thought that far forward. Some people who come here haven't done that. You articulated very well. Have you considered these other funds, the legacy funds, et cetera? You know, we're seeing kind of a pattern here in the environment and natural resources area. We had discussions about land in Minnesota, and we continue to buy more land with the legacy dollars, and we don't have the ability or we don't have the funding to provide for the maintenance and management of that land. This seems to be consistent with that. You guys are building out more parks and more trails, and you know, how are you going to pay for managing them? Have you considered using those legacy dollars for managing them, managing in what you have rather than continuing to build out more liabilities with which to manage?
Mr. Carlson, comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we certainly are looking at that, and I think as you hear the proposal for legacy funds that may come to this committee later in the session, you'll see a slight bit of a philosophical change from the Metro Regional Agency. We're recognizing that we no longer can build new facilities or acquire new parkland, and when you look at the suggestion of how we propose to spend some of those legacy dollars, most of the projects that we're looking at are taking care of what we have. So that's rehabilitation of some of our aging facilities, taking care of trail pavement, pavement management, and not expanding the system because we just financially can't sustain that any longer. We're also very cautious to recognize the language of the Constitution that it's not to supplant existing funding. So we're trying to make sure and ensure that we draw that very clear boundary between the two, that some of the legacy funding isn't supplanting some of those traditional funding sources that may go into operations and maintenance or other categories that might be included.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam, to this point.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to understand what were the total legacy fund dollars that you received the past since this started?
Mr. Carlson, the total legacy, is it for Three Rivers you're asking or for the Metro Parks?
I believe since it was, 40-some percent was devoted to Metro, I'd like to understand what that meant in total millions of dollars.
Representative Quam, we're going to have the legacy bill before this committee. The legacy is made up of approximately 200 and almost $300 million. The parks part is 14% of that number, and you're 42% of the 14 of the one of the 290. Mr. Carlson, do you know that number?
Mr. Chair, I do, in fact, happen to have that in front of me. The number for the last biennium was $27 million for the Metro Regional Park System in the 42% that you mentioned.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, we must be getting a signal here, folks, that we're supposed to wrap up, so I'm not sure. I apologize again for the noise, but we've only got a couple more that want to comment on this. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that you know the numbers on where the sales tax is generated, and I look forward to the discussion when the legacy bill comes here and 95% of the Outdoor Heritage Fund goes to Greater Minnesota, and that we actually have folks who on the council vote against any Metro project funding. Looking forward to that discussion when that bill comes here. But to the testifiers, I have a question, and maybe this is to you as the chair as well. So we have the governor's recommendation, we have this bill, and then we have the targets are going to be set, and the budget bill coming forward, and the legacy bill coming forward. So how in the process is this going to work so that we're not substituting legacy dollars for a cut that occurs in the general fund?
Representative Hansen, to the part that applies to me, that's going to be a judgment that many of us are going to weigh in. Representative Wagenius has weighed in significantly in that discussion in the legacy committee. Our intention is to do our omnibus bill next week. I think there's a strong probability that that will include the LCCMR bill in that bill. It will not include the legacy bill. So when the legacy bill comes forward later on, I would imagine we'll have significant discussion about how those two bills relate to each other. I think Mr. Carlson articulated some of the challenges they're seeing and how the legacy money is used differently and is supposed to be used differently. Very clear that it's supposed to supplement, not supplant. That being said, the realization is the governor laid out to cut Metro Parks 40%, but if I'm not mistaken, suggested an increase of 12% in legacy. The governor evidently felt that he could justify that wasn't supplanting. I anticipate we will not, Representative Hackbart, because I know how passionate you are for Metro Parks and you've been in your 16 years as a member of the legislature, that I anticipate we are going to do better for Metro Parks than the governor did in the base budget. So I don't anticipate as significant a supplanting issue on this particular one. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. Mr. Carlson, you're very well prepared and have all the numbers. Just one more legacy question. Of that 14% that was available for statewide grants, how much did the Metro Parks get out of that particular pot of money?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the grant amount that was provided was roughly about $7 million. Actually, it was over that. It was for about $8 million. The Metro Regional Park System received $1.7 million of that amount.
Thank you. Representative Hackbart, we'll lay your bill over for possible inclusion. Members, we're adjourned.
Thank you.